welcome to iPharmRx, where we explore the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, Editor-in-Chief of iPharmRx, and today's podcast, we're going to be talking about the recently released clinical practice guidelines for the prevention, detection, evaluation, and treatment of high blood pressure in adults, which were produced by the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, and subsequently endorsed by 9 other health professional organizations, including the American Pharmacists Association. And now we posted on iPharmRx a super brief summary of the top 10 things we believe every clinician should know about these guidelines. And joining me today are Kristen Reiser, the lead author of the iPharmRx summary, and longstanding iPharmRx contributors, Joseph Sassine and Eric McLaughlin. Dr. Reiser is an ambulatory care clinical specialist at St. Vincent, Indianapolis, and an adjunct faculty member for the Purdue University College of Pharmacy. And Dr. Sassine joins us from the University of Colorado, Skaggs School of Pharmacy and Pharmaceutical Sciences. And Dr. McLaughlin is at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center School of Pharmacy. And in addition, Eric was a member of the ACC-AHA task force that developed the new guidelines. So Kristen, Joe, Eric, it's great to have all of you here today to talk about the management of high blood pressure and the new ACC-AHA guidelines.
Thank you for including me in this discussion,
Stuart, and I look forward to discussing this topic.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, Stuart.
So I'd like to direct my first question to you, Eric, for the benefit of our audience who may not be familiar with the guideline development process. Can you give us kind of an insider's view of how these guidelines were developed and who were the members of the task force along with you?
Sure. Well, just for some background, in 2013, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, so the NHLBI, Advisory Council recommended that the NHLBI partner with other organizations to develop guideline recommendations. And so at that time, the ACC and HA collaborated with NHLBI and other stakeholder organizations to basically complete and publish 4 other guidelines that were or had been in the works. That includes cholesterol, lifestyle modifications to reduce cardiovascular risk assessment, and guidelines on overweight and obesity in adults. In 2014, the ACC and HA basically led this process and partnered, as you mentioned, with 9 other organizations to basically lead the development of these new blood pressure guidelines. And so there was members on each of these organizations actually on the guideline writing panel itself. So it was a very multidisciplinary group. We had cardiologists on that guideline writing committee, epidemiologists, internists. There was an endocrinologist, there was a geriatrician, a nephrologist, a nurse, a pharmacist, in this case it was me, a physician assistant, and actually 2 lay members or patient representatives. So it was a very multidisciplinary group, and again, a broad swath of organizations that were involved in this writing and development of these guidelines. The guideline process used was a very evidence-based approach. There were specific questions that the committee wanted answered through specific meta-analysis that was actually commissioned and done by the Evidence Review Committee. There was a very specific process for doing literature searches, to putting evidence tables together, and to actually drafting the guidelines with whatever class of recommendation and level of evidence goes with that recommendation. So all told, it was a very long and labor-intensive process. I think the guideline writing committee looked at close to 1,000 studies. So it was a very extensive and evidence-based process.
So Kristen and Joe, both of you have had some time now to read and digest these guidelines, all 816 pages of them. What were some of the recommendations that initially jumped out to you? Perhaps they were a bit of a surprise, and why?
I think first off for me was the universal blood pressure goal of less than 130 over 80. I haven't been practicing for very long, but since I have been practicing, there's always been those differences based on maybe a patient's age or comorbidity, such as diabetes. I haven't seen a lot of new evidence that's come out, specifically in patients with diabetes, that would support lowering the blood pressure goal to less than 130. And the American Diabetes Association actually released their standards of care a little early. So Last week it was available online, and they still endorse that blood pressure goal of less than 140 over 90 for most patients. So that's the biggest recommendation that kind of jumped out at me that was a little bit of a surprise. The only other thing that is going to be a new thing for me to wrap my head around is starting two medications for a blood pressure over 140 over 90. It makes sense, since we lowered the ranges for both stage 1 and stage 2 hypertension, to start two medications. But seeing a patient in clinic with a blood pressure of, let's say, 144 over 91, it's just going to have to be a change of practice, and I'm going to have to catch myself in clinic to think to start them on potentially two medications at that time.
And I guess I'll chime in too. I haven't been that surprised. I think I drank the Kool-Aid back in February. I was one of the expert reviewers of these guidelines. So I've seen them for almost a year. So I've had that time to assimilate. I'm in the lower blood pressure goals, definitely one that jumps out. But I tell you, if you really look at the source evidence, and I'm not just talking about the SPRINT trial, all the meta-analyses that are referred to and even more seem to pop up now, I guess I've really accepted that lower is better. So less than 130 over 80 really is, it's one that I've become much more personally comfortable with as a clinician, and now recommending it in practice since we're not embargoed. Now these results are released. So that, I think I had to look to the source evidence, not just one clinical trial, to actually make me highly comfortable, but I've gotten to that point. The starting with two drugs is very interesting. I think even if we go back to JNC7, I remember when that recommendation to start with two drugs in patients with stage 2, that was a hard sell. And I think it's no longer a hard sell in stage 2, but I direct people back to that JNC7, even in stage 1. Back then, they were listing mono or combination therapy for initial management. Nobody chose it. I mean, most people did not in just stage 1 back then. So I think that's one that I think if we just go back and sort of see the reality that most people need two drugs, I think adding all that additional information does make it a little bit more palatable. But I do agree that those are probably the two things that jump out. The things that are now jumping out at me, though, are distilled down to, one, the importance of measuring blood pressure accurately. I think that is a huge thing that I would be more comfortable if patients were the ones pushing that process, because I think it would have more success than just trying to educate healthcare professionals alone on how to do it correctly. I think it's really important enough to make clinical decisions based on real values. So that really is very prominent in my mind. The second thing that jumps out is, wow, this is such an opportunity for clinical pharmacy, because these guidelines, maybe it's thanks to Eric for opening up people's eyes to the benefits of collaborative approaches, team-based care, and involving clinical pharmacists is within this guideline. And it is a proven strategy to help get patients controlled. And it jumps out to me when I'm talking to students or other pharmacists as a clear calling for us to work at the top of our license.
Well, Eric, I'm certain many of the recommendations were critically debated by the guideline development team. From my perspective, the universal blood pressure target of less than 130 over 80 is perhaps among the recommendations that will generate the most discussion. In fact, I think it already has. I can see the logic, and I personally agree with having a consistent blood pressure target for everyone. From a public health perspective, it certainly makes messaging about the goal much clearer, but it's also a pretty substantial departure from what guidelines in the past have recommended, which really took into account such things as age and comorbid conditions. Can you give us a sense of why the guidelines committee recommended a kind of single universal blood pressure goal regardless of age and comorbidities?
That's a really good question, Stuart. You know, I think from a 30,000 foot view, you know, the goal of these guidelines are really to ultimately reduce morbidity and mortality of hypertension. And we want to really put forth recommendations that are evidence-based that will be used and understood by clinicians and patients. And so I think there has to be this balance on ease of use and understanding as well in order for those recommendations to get implemented in general practice. And that's certainly the approach that the guideline writing committee took. So, you know, as might be expected, though, the levels of evidence when you're talking about these different blood pressure goals aren't really going to necessarily be the same. And so the evidence used to make those decisions are going to vary. For instance, if you look at patients maybe with cardiovascular disease or those at high risk, we have, you know, strong evidence from not only just well-designed randomized controlled trials to lower blood pressure goals are better, such as SPRINT, but as Joe alluded to earlier, you know, additional more recent meta-analyses that have come out that have demonstrated that lower is better. And so, for instance, if we look just specifically at SPRINT, that target there was less than 120 over 80. But an important thing to keep in mind when you're thinking about that study is the method in which the blood pressure was measured. It was different than we typically do in the normal clinic setting. When you get to the patients, though, who might be at very, very low risk, think about your younger patients that don't have underlying cardiovascular disease. You know, the data from prospective randomized controlled trials is a bit lacking in that area that shows a decrease in cardiovascular outcomes. But that said, there's strong epidemiological evidence that the patients with elevated blood pressure are certainly at significant risk for cardiovascular mortality, stroke, and heart attacks. We know that there's a logarithmic increase in coronary heart disease events as blood pressure increases beyond normal. So for instance, above 115 millimeters of mercury, if you get an increased systolic blood pressure of 20, that basically doubles your risk for stroke and heart attack and other vascular diseases. So is it really practical to have a prospective randomized control trial that might last 20 or 30 years and involve tens of thousands of patients in order to demonstrate that, yes, these lower blood pressure goals actually lower cardiovascular events in low-risk patients? You know, is that realistic? I don't think so. So in the absence of that, and in strong pathophysiological evidence, epidemiological evidence, and, of course, we have strong observational data showing that events go up, then I think that does lend to a recommendation for a lower blood pressure goal in those patients so we can prevent these types of events from occurring 20, 30, 40 years down the road.
I think we would all agree, though, that the blood pressure goal of 130 over 80 isn't appropriate for everyone. I mean, it might be the goal from a general sense, but there are circumstances when it probably isn't appropriate in an individual patient to have that as a target. So are there any patient populations where you might actually try to achieve a somewhat relaxed goal? And then conversely, are there some patient populations where you would actually try to achieve a goal of 120 over 80, such was done in SPRINT?
I think it's important to note that there is a part of the guideline that talks about treating hypertension in older patients. And the general message is that you should not adjust your goal up just based on somebody's numeric age. But they do have in there for patients who are above the age of 65, who have a shortened life expectancy and a high burden of comorbidity. I think that is quite vague, and it's meant to be quite vague. They don't identify a specific blood pressure value, but they do state that it should be a collaborative discussion with the patient and with other healthcare providers and a team-based approach. I think that sends a message that that might be a population where you don't treat to the standard goal. Those patients, FYI, are basically the exclusion criteria for the SPRINT trial. So it sort of makes sense in that regard. And it probably deals with the most fragile population. As far as treating to a tight normal blood pressure of less than 120 over 80, I tell you, I am not thinking of a patient population I would recommend that for. My primary reluctance would be if we really want to use what was in the SPRINT, we'd have to monitor people exactly like the SPRINT. Monitor them by measuring their blood pressure three times at every clinic visit, separated by 5 minutes in a dark room with them quiet in that structured environment and having really that very frequent assessment for side effects and for other toxicities. With all those safeguards, maybe I'd be tempted into treating lower, but I think that's probably a bit implausible. The guidelines do a good job of trying to frame how to generally care for patients and follow up in a prudent manner, but I don't think they go to the diligence that was sort of enforced strictly in the SPRINT.
When you look at the recommendations for blood pressure in older patients, they say specifically community-dwelling, ambulatory older patients, i.e. doesn't apply to nursing home patients or those extremely frail or high comorbid disease burden or low life expectancy. And I would also stress that the guidelines are there to guide. They don't really replace clinical judgment. And I think there's a statement in the guidelines that do specifically point that out.
I think for me, when looking at the less stringent goal versus the 130 over 80, I kind of look at it like I do when I'm trying to decide who gets an A1C of 7% or 8%. By looking at their comorbidities, their fall risk, their ability to complete their activities of daily living, and then their life expectancy. So a very similar approach.
So, Joe, Kristen, given the recommendations in these guidelines, how do you see your practice changing? What are some of the things that you're already doing in the past month based on these guidelines? And what do you think will be some of the more difficult recommendations to achieve, even in the long run?
I think the most difficult thing is really getting to the blood pressure goals. I can tell you what I do now is I'm very critical of the blood pressure measurement, and I'm not making a clinical decision based on one value. Even in a clinic setting, I'm making sure that I'm seeing myself actually questioning more, making sure that I've done my due diligence, that the clinical metric that I'm looking at to make a decision is an accurate one, and that's an average of two values. That done with my safeguards, I am recommending less than 130 over 80. With that said, I don't expect that quality metrics that are used by value-based reimbursement, you know, payment methodologies like HEDIS measures and other recommended core measures, I don't think they're going to go down to 130 over 80 for a period of time. It took them so long to lower the LDL when LDL goals went down way back when. So I think that'll lag a little bit. So it won't hit financially, maybe health systems that have value-based reimbursement monies that they're receiving. The other thing I can see is I think that we're going to see more pharmacist involvement in managing this chronic illness because of the need for more intense treatment and more risk of side effects.
Yeah, I completely agree that getting to the actual goals is going to be the hardest thing about this. And I think also another question is, how are we going to incorporate home blood pressure monitoring into managing these patients? Because a lot of my patients can't afford a home blood pressure monitor. We had a meeting earlier this week with all of our ambulatory care pharmacists to kind of come up with a game plan. And, you know, we've talked about trying to get grants to have patients come to education sessions to learn how to properly use their home blood pressure monitors, and then they get one. And it's an incentive to get them to come to the meeting for some education, and they get the benefit of being able to check their blood pressure at home. In my clinic, we have family medicine and internal medicine residents. So a big task for us is going to be educating them, because when they're in the middle of their training, to not only read this guideline, given its length, but also digest the new information is going to be challenging for them. So really being that educational resource for them. And I'm hoping that in my clinic that we'll have a higher volume of hypertension patients referred to us. So I typically don't see a lot in clinic because we like our medical residents to get that educational experience and learn how to manage those patients. But with the recommended monthly follow-up, I'm not sure that they'll be able to accommodate that many follow-ups.
So Kristen, Joe, Eric, thank you really for your insights about the new ACC-AHA guidelines for the prevention, detection, evaluation, and treatment of high blood pressure in adults. And no doubt these guidelines will have a profound impact on practice over the next few years. And as we've already seen in the lay coverage and some of the health professional media and press, the recommendations have created a bit of a buzz. And we'd love to hear what you think, our audience, iFormerX members, we'd love to hear what you think about the new guidelines. Are there recommendations you believe are long overdue? Are there recommendations you think lack sufficient evidence? Are there recommendations that you think will be misinterpreted, misconstrued, or misused? Well, let us know what you think by posting a comment or two. Remember, only iFormerX members can post comments and use the interactive features on the site. And you can become a member of iFormerX. It's free. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX, signing off.